Well, good morning. I hope you can all hear me. My pod is scratching at me, so my volume control. I shouldn't say pot so easily, right? Well, today, I wanted to remind you, tonight between 7 and 9, we're having our Christmas party for the staff. And it's always a fun thing to listen to because we get a little crazy and we sing Christmas songs and stuff like that. Now, I will not be here. I've been informed by my wife that I will not be here because of COVID, but you can join and I can join by listening on the air, and we would love to have you. Well, today on the air, which is the name of this program, with Glenn Coble, that's me, we have a special guest, not terribly special because we have him every month, but Fred Malone, are you on? Are you there?
I'm with you, Glenn.
Very good. How are you doing in this snowy day?
Well, it wasn't too bad last night. I see that the streets are clear. I managed, to get my little doggy out for her walk this morning, and so the streets were fine, a little wet, but no snow on them. And
you have a little doggy too?
Oh yeah, I got a little cocker spaniel.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Little doggies keep us smiling, don't they?
Oh, they do. Absolutely. Well, any dog keeps me smiling.
Yeah, me too.
We're big. Yeah, I care less.
Hey, I forgot to do something at the beginning of this that I want to do. I had a first in my show. I get phone calls from people saying, you know, nice things, and occasionally not so nice things, but and I get texts quite often telling me where to go and so forth. Yesterday my wife said, do you know this person? She showed me this little letter from Mrs. Elsie Mitchell. And I said, no, I don't think I know that person. I opened it up, and it was one of our listeners that sent me a really nice little happy 51st wedding anniversary note.
Wasn't that nice?
Because that's coming up on the 21st of this month. So,
that's great.
Yeah, and I'm pretty proud that that's my very first letter from a listener, other than people that have sent letters in for a swap shop. So that's great.
Well, that's good. That's great to hear.
I wanted to get that in before I forgot.
Absolutely.
So today we're going to talk about what, Fred?
We're
going to
pick up where we left off when I was here last
month. That's right.
We're going to talk about presidential elections.
Yeah. Are we up to Lincoln yet?
Yes. We finished with Andrew Johnson.
Yes, okay.
The last time, so we'll pick up with Grant. But before I do that, I just wanted to mention that the Marion County Historical Society is closed for the winter.
Okay.
We won't be opening again until spring if everything goes well with COVID.
Now, is that normal? Is that normal?
Yes. Okay. We always close in December. We normally stay open until after Christmas on the weekends, but with COVID and all and the way it has spiraled, they decided to close a couple weeks early.
However,
I wanted to mention was, oftentimes around the holidays, people like to stop in and buy books for presents.
Yes.
Because we do have a really great selection of books on local history and so forth, and a lot of local authors. And Randy Wendland just came out with a new book. I forget the title of it, something about Marion Memories, I think it is.
Okay.
And that's available if people are interested in that. So if they want a book, they can either purchase it online by going to marionhistory.com and clicking on books or a gift shop, and they're all listed. Or if they want it right away, they can call the museum or just stop down any day, Monday through Friday. Go to the State Street side entrance, ring the bell, and the girls can take care of you. Or you can call ahead, and they will bring the book out to your car, and you can pay for it with credit card or whatever.
Okay, so you have people there, you're just not open for
public.
Yes, right.
Yeah. The girls in the office are there Monday through Friday. I think they start at 8 in the morning there till 4 in the afternoon.
Okay.
So again, you can call the museum, and right now the number escapes me, but it's in the phone book, or you can look it up on our website, MarionHistory.com. But those books are still available through the holidays. Monday through Friday, you can stop and pick one up if you want to give them for gifts. And especially as I see with Randy's new book, Marion Memories, I have not seen a copy of it, but there was a nice article in the paper, I think either Monday or Tuesday of this week, that talked about the new book. and I'm sure a lot of people will be interested in getting that book. You know, he had one last year that came out about the old quarry, and that was very well taken. And he, of course, he has two postcard books that were published the last few years that are also available at the bookshop.
Scott should have mentioned that he had Heloise on early today and he kept asking her what the best gift for somebody you don't know what to buy. That sounds like a terrific gift for anybody who is a Marianite type person.
Absolutely.
Great gift.
And as I said, we normally sell quite a few books during the holiday time.
Yeah, I bet
especially
you.
Especially when people, you know, when people are coming into town to visit. Now, that may not be the case this year. But I'm sure a lot of people would be interested in buying those, even for other relatives, or could be mailed, you know, to their other relatives.
I imagine reading is up during this.
Well, and of course, with the Facebook page, you know, that has Marian Memories and things on it, that's visited every day by multiple hundreds of people.
Really? Wow.
This just goes along that line. But the museum is actually closed now and won't reopen until spring. So.
Okay. Well, now I've almost forgot one other housekeeping thing I have to do. I will try to forewarn you about a minute or 30 seconds before each break because we have
that's
a break
fine.
On each quarter hour.
Sure, that's fine. And I'll try to watch the clock, too. I don't know whether our clocks are the same or not, but I've got about 10:23 right now.
It's about, in 10 seconds, it'll be 10:24.
Okay, so we're fairly close.
Okay.
So don't feel bad to interrupt me. And so, folks know, I am calling in today. I'm
in that's
the studio,
right.
So, and again, my wife concerned with COVID as well as I am.
Sure.
So we're kind of working from home.
So if you have...
With Mike Wilson on his Monday night show. Actually, since late summer, I've been doing my show call-in with him. So.
Okay. Well, now, if people want to text or message me a question that I can ask you, just go to Glenn Coble at Facebook and just message me, and I will pass it along to you.
Yeah, right. Unfortunately, they won't be able to call in this morning since I'm on the line.
You're on the line. All right.
All right. And again, don't feel bad about interrupting me because I'll just keep going until I hear you.
Okay, excellent.
All right, we left off with Andrew Johnson, so we're going to pick up with Ulysses Grant.
Okay.
Ulysses Grant was the 18th president elected by the populace, and Ulysses Grant was a Republican. Now, his first term, his opponent was Horatio Seymour, and Horatio Seymour was a Democrat. And I'm not sure what his background was. I couldn't find a whole lot of information on him. He could have been in Congress or possibly the Senate.
Was this at a time where they voted for both the president and the vice president separately?
Right.
Okay.
He would have had a running mate. And I didn't bother looking up the running mates. I probably should have.
Okay.
But I didn't bother looking up the running mates. Some of them I know. This one I don't.
Okay.
But his first term opponent was Horatio Seymour, who was a Democrat. The popular vote was as follows. In the first term, 3,015,071 votes for Ulysses Grant and 2,709,000 votes
fairly close.
For Seymour. So close, but not so much.
Yeah.
In the Electoral College, I want to keep saying electrical, and sometimes it does get a little sparky.
This year.
This year especially. 214 to 80. So Electoral College was, you know, pretty well
a landslide.
Grant's favor, right. Then in his second term, and this was very interesting because people will remember this name, his opponent was Horace Greeley, who was a Democrat. Of course, we all know Horace Greeley, who was a publisher of the New York Times, and said, "Go West, young man," trying to push people to the West.
Yep.
In this particular election, the popular vote was, and I'll just round these off, 3,500,000 to 2,800,000.
Okay.
And in the Electoral College, 286-0. Evidently, Greeley's background in the newspaper business wasn't too popular.
I guess.
So he didn't fare too well. And as it happens, of course, the election was held on, I believe, November the 3rd that year. Greeley died on the 29th of November.
Oh, wow.
Just 26 days after the election.
He wasn't in great health when he was running.
Had he been elected, there are great chances that whoever his vice presidential running mate would have been sworn in.
Yeah.
So 26 days after, before the inauguration was held, he passed away.
Wow. Huh.
So moving on to the 19th president, Rutherford B. Hayes, an Ohioan, a Republican. in his first term and his only term. His opponent was Samuel J. Tilden, and I think a lot of people will remember Samuel Tilden.
Yes.
He was a prominent politician, also an inventor. He was a Democrat.
Now, was Hayes from Lancaster?
No, actually, he was from Delaware.
Delaware, okay.
Right. He was born in Delaware, and he eventually went to Fremont to practice law.
Okay.
And so that's where he was elected when he was president. Was elected president. Unfortunately, his home is no longer in existence in Delaware. You can see the site where it was. If you go to Delaware, go downtown, turn the corner, I can't remember the name of the street, but it's
Sandusky?
Pretty much on the main square. Off of Sandusky.
Okay.
And there's a BP gas station where he was born. There is
okay.
a historical marker there. And just this past summer, on the opposite corner across from City Hall, they erected a really nice statue of Lucifer B. Hayes, native son of Delaware.
I'll run down
but
and look at
he lived the majority
it.
Of his life in Fremont.
Okay.
And he was a graduate of Ohio Wesleyan, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
But in that particular election, the popular vote was as follows. And I'm going to give this one right out to the number because it's kind of interesting.
Okay.
Again, running against Samuel Tilden. Popular vote for Hayes was 4,033,950 votes, 4,033,000. And Tilden scored 4,284,000.
Ooh, that was close.
Votes. So actually, Tilden won the popular vote.
Yeah.
But in the Electoral College, it was 185 to 184.
Oh, that's, yes, I think they talked about him during this last
and
thing.
I know we're getting close to a break.
Yeah, we got about 50 seconds.
Okay, I wanted to read a little bit about that particular election. So
okay. We can hang loose for 30 seconds, all right?
And yeah, I'll just hold off. Again, a little bit more about Rutherford B. Hayes for those people that may not know. He has a beautiful estate in Fremont, if folks have never been there, at the Hayes Presidential Center.
Huh.
It's about 33 acres. It's just off the downtown area. Has a beautiful presidential library, and his home is actually there. And you can tour both. It's called Spiegel Grove, and he's buried there along with his wife and his horse was with him all throughout the Civil War.
Well, we're going to have to break here in 5 seconds, all right?
Sounds good.
Hang on.
Bring us some figgy pudding. We always hear that at Christmas. What is figgy pudding?
Well, figgy pudding is a type of Christmas pudding which was originally made with figs. It may be baked, steamed in the oven, boiled, or fried.
Wow, Charlie, that was detailed. How do you know so much about figgy pudding?
Well, I've got a smartphone.
Happy holidays from WWGH Radio 107.1 FM.
Which button am I?
When every second counts, you can't wing it.
Guys, a little help up here?
In a home fire, you may have less than 2 minutes to get out. So make a family home fire escape plan. Then practice home fire drills at least twice a year so everyone knows what to do when they hear. Prepare your family at ready.gov/firedrill. Brought to you by FEMA, the Ag Council, and Make Safe Happen.
Yeah, we're back here on the air. That's
okay.
The name of the show. And I've got Fred Malone. He's talking about President Rutherford B. Hayes,
right.
Who's
now,
from Ohio.
We think we have some controversy in this year's election, which we do. But they had controversy back in those days, too. Now, this was 1876. And as I said, Hayes lost the popular vote by quite a bit. But he won the Electoral College vote by one vote. Now, the country had something to be cynical about in the 1876 election.
Hmm.
On the morning after Election Day, the newspapers announced the results. Tilden, the winner, 4,300,000 popular votes and 196 electoral votes. To Hayes, 4,036,298 to 173. Now, originally, the Electoral College was in Tilden's favor as well as the popular vote. But the Republicans would not concede.
Oh. Now,
sound familiar?
Yeah.
They claim that in three southern states, Tilden carried, Louisiana, South Carolina, and Florida, Negroes had been unlawfully kept from going to the polls.
Mm-hmm.
Had they been allowed to vote, Hayes would have been elected. Republican leaders and Southern Democrats met and made a deal. The three states would throw their electoral votes to Hayes, thereby giving him the election, 185 to 184 in the Electoral College, provided that federal troops would be withdrawn and the states would be allowed to control their own affairs.
Uh-huh.
The bargain made, and it was kept. An electoral commission created by Congress decided in favor of Hayes on March the 2nd, 1877, just 56 hours before the inauguration.
That's interesting. I bet that's brought up quite often when people now are kind of not liking the idea of having electoral college.
And I wanted to mention Hayes had nothing to do with the stolen election.
Ah, okay.
And they are calling it a stolen election because of the deal that was made in Congress.
Okay.
So we don't know whether the same thing's going to occur on January the 6th or not.
Yeah, well, it's pretty much likely that even if it is attempted to be stolen, it can't be. But
well, that's what we are under the impression.
We're being told that, yeah.
But we see what happened in 1870.
Yeah.
So, you know, just because we've got a controversy going on in 2020, it's happened before in our process.
That's interesting.
Moving on to James Garfield, also an Ohioan.
And don't we have a school named Garfield?
We do.
Yes.
Yeah, we do. I think we've got a Hayes here, too.
Also. Oh, yeah, that's right, we do.
All the schools in the area for Ohio presidents.
Yeah.
The 1880 election, the 20th president of the United States, James A. Garfield, who was a Republican, and the third Ohioan in a row. Right, Grant, Hayes, and now Garfield.
I'll be darned.
In his first term and his only term, he was opposed by Winfield S. Hancock. Remember Winfield Hancock?
I can't say I do.
He was a Democrat. He was very much active in the Mexican War back when Polk was president in the 1840s, and also he was very much involved in the Civil War as a general.
Okay.
So he had a lot of military background.
Okay.
In the popular vote, Garfield won 4,449,000 to 4,442,000, only a 9,464 vote margin. So
yeah,
a very close election in the popular vote, still won by Garfield.
Yeah.
And in the Electoral College, 214 to 155.
Uh-huh.
So he had plenty of room there.
Yeah.
However, in July the 2nd of 1881, just a few months after he was sworn into office, he was assassinated.
Yeah, I knew that.
Now, he did linger throughout the summer and didn't die until September the 19th at 10:30 in the morning. And it's interesting because at the time, Alexander Graham Bell had devised a new apparatus that would be able to find where the bullet was, and they thought maybe they could get it that way.
Huh.
So he was summoned to the White House, He was summoned to the White House, and they did do some exploration with that particular device.
A magnetic resonancing
like that.
Thing?
Yeah, right. And they did, here I found it. Alexander Graham Bell was summoned to the White House to find the exact location of the bullet by means of his induction balance device. Induction balance. The president lingered on through the hot summer. On September the 6th, he was moved in a special train to the seaside town of Elberon, New Jersey, where they thought maybe the sea air would help improve him, where his wife constantly attended him and prepared all of his meals. Now, they located the bullet, but they were not able to extract it.
No.
Garfield seemed to be recovering until the 19th of September, when he awoke with a chill and grew progressively weaker, and he died later that night at 10:30.
Okay.
So even though they had some semblance of new modern medicine, it was unable to save him because gangrene obviously had set in by that time. But he did spend a very, very bad summer.
Did he do any legislation during? I mean, was
no,
he
absolutely
involved?
Nothing happened during that time because he wasn't sworn in until March. Back in those days, they were inaugurated in March.
Yeah.
So he only had April, May, June, July, basically, and nothing.
Who was
happened.
His vice president?
The next man that was elected was actually succeeded him.
Yeah.
Who was never elected president, only vice president for James Garfield, Chester A. Arthur.
Oh, okay.
But he became the 21st president of the United States.
Okay.
And he did not choose to run for his own term. So he merely served out the roughly 3 years and 6 months of Garfield Garfield's term and served as the 21st president, was never actually elected president, never went on to run on his own.
Now, did you mention whether he was a Democratic or Republican?
He was a Republican,
okay.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So that carried on. Winfield Hancock, the opponent of Garfield, was a Democrat.
Okay.
So Chester Arthur was a Republican. And interestingly enough, Chester Arthur had no political experience whatsoever when he was chosen to be vice president. His only experience in the public life at all was he was the harbor commissioner, customs commissioner for the city of New York.
Hmm. Okay.
And that was the only political experience he had at all.
Huh.
And maybe that was why he decided not to run on his own term. He was called Gentleman Chester Arthur. He was a very dapper-looking gentleman. In his portraits, you can see why he was called Dapper Chester.
Okay.
Okay, moving on then to the 22nd president of the United States, and this is also going to start to create kind of an interesting scenario over the next several years.
Okay.
This was in 1884, and that gentleman's name was Grover Cleveland, and he was from New York. And he was a Democrat. I'm sure everyone's heard of Grover Cleveland before.
Sure.
In his first term, he was opposed by a gentleman by the name of James G. Blaine, who was a Republican. Blaine was a popular politician at the time and thought to be a very good challenger for Grover Cleveland. And actually, he was. He turned out to be.
Mm-hmm.
In the popular vote, Grover Cleveland garnered 4,911,017 votes to Blaine's 4,848,334 votes.
We were having some close elections
back
then.
A margin of only 62,000 and some odd votes difference.
Yeah.
And in the Electoral College, the vote was 219 to 182. So he did have a clear-cut margin in the Electoral College. But again, a very close election with regard to the popular vote and the people. And you're starting to see now, over the last few elections, the number of people voting starting to climb. As you remember, in some of our early elections, Adams, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, we're only talking 2 million people voting.
Yeah.
So by now the country has really started to grow, right?
Yeah.
And the number of states have started to grow by that time.
Huh.
Now, might want to mention that Grover Cleveland was a bachelor when married.
Mm-hmm.
When married. He was a bachelor when he was elected president, and he is later on to become the first and only president to be married in the White House.
I'll be
darned.
And
the interesting part about him was he married his godchild.
Oh, my.
The gal that he married was actually his goddaughter, his best friend's daughter.
How much younger was she?
I don't know the exact, but about 30 years.
Oh, my.
Yeah, a considerable difference in their ages. So he did. She did serve, of course, as his first lady.
Sure.
He was then defeated for re-election. Now, we're not sure whether that was the reason or not. And again, it was a close election because in 1888, when he was defeated for re-election, he was beaten by the now 23rd president, Benjamin Harrison, also from Ohio, who was a Republican. Again, Grover Cleveland, a Democrat, running for re-election, got defeated by Harrison.
There for about 30 years, we were the hotbed of presidents.
We were. We absolutely were. And the popular vote in that election, 5,440,216 to 5,538,233, a difference of only 98,000 votes.
Now, we're going to have a test on this afterwards, and you better have those numbers right.
Well, it's interesting, and again, I don't want to complicate things by giving these vote totals, but I think it's interesting to see, especially when they're close like what's going on in the country. So
you got a
president that's running for re-election, who gets married in the White House to his goddaughter, who is considerably younger than him, and gets defeated by another Ohioan by a slim margin.
Yeah.
Now, in the electoral vote, 233 to 168. So, again, not so close in the Electoral College, but in the popular vote, very, very close.
Yeah.
Very,
yeah.
very close.
Interesting.
Now, here comes the twist in fate. 4 years later, in 1892... Harrison runs again as the incumbent. Here comes old Grover back again, the Democrat. He's going to give it another shot.
Why not?
Why not? So in Benjamin Harrison's attempt to be reelected for a second term, he loses.
Uh-huh.
He loses to Grover Cleveland. coming back now to be elected the 24th president.
Now, he was the only president that did that, wasn't he?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The popular vote in this particular election, 5,554,000 to 5,190,000.
And by the way, that was the year my grandfather was born.
1892.
Uh-huh.
Excellent. So really, a small difference, 363,000, when you're talking about almost 11 million people voting. Now, in the popular, electoral vote, 277 to 145. Now, I got to mention, too, there was a third candidate in this particular election, a guy by the name of James Weaver, who was a member of the People's Party.
I had never heard of the People's
Party.
He didn't
fare so well, but he did collect over a million votes, and he got 22 votes in the Electoral College. But it
kind of the Ross Perot of his day, huh?
Absolutely. Or George Wallace, maybe.
There you go.
It didn't affect the outcome, obviously.
Yeah.
Cleveland was elected over Harrison, and so Harrison went home. But as you said before, Cleveland was the only president to serve two terms not consecutively.
Hmm. Now, did he, the guy that ran as a third party, did he collect a lot of electoral votes?
Just 22.
Okay, so.
Yeah, just 22. So it wouldn't have affected it.
It didn't affect
that.
Even
if Harrison would have gotten the additional 22 electoral votes, he would have still only ended up with 167 to 277. So Cleveland had definitely had a clear margin.
Okay.
So this is interesting because that has never happened. It hadn't happened before, and it hadn't happened since, that a president loses, comes back, and wins again. So
yeah, that's
will
weird.
Trump try to win a second to do this in 2024?
That, yeah, 2024, we might find out.
We're already hearing rumblings of that, from what I understand.
Well, now, that's kind of brings up an interesting point. If he does run in 2024 and loses the popular vote, he will have lost the popular vote three times.
That's true.
And if he wins, that will be amazing.
It would be. Another Grover.
Yeah, there you go.
I think we're close, aren't we?
Yeah, we're getting down to 30 seconds. So.
Okay, so it really shows that, you know, we think we've had some idiosyncrasies occurring in 2020, but idiosyncrasies were occurring in our elections long before now.
Yeah, history kind of repeats itself,
doesn't it?
Yeah, and you're a fool if you don't pay attention to history, I believe.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right.
All right, well, we're talking with Fred Malone from the Marion Historical Society, talking about presidents, and we're going to be back here in about a minute and a half, I believe.
Sounds good.
We'll take a break.
Scott, New York is such a wonderful place to be during the holiday season.
I know the tree in Rockefeller Center, Macy's department store, and a Santa Claus on every street corner.
Well, not every street corner. Even Santa won't go near Central Park at Christmas.
WWGH Radio 107.1 FM, the place for the holiday season.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
You're here on, you're listening to On the Air with Glenn Coble, and my special guest is Fred Malone, who's giving us a history lesson on presidents. Go for it, Fred. I pushed up the wrong pot, so go back again.
Okay, we're
there? You go. Yep,
okay. We're here. So we just finished up with Grover Cleveland, again, the only president to serve two terms not in consecutive order. And now we're going to move on to the year of 1896, which is a very important year in my family because that is the year that the 25th president of the United States was elected, and his name was William McKinley.
Mm-hmm.
He was a Republican, and William McKinley and I are related. He's my third cousin.
I'll be darned.
He's my third cousin on my mother's side. We share a grandfather. So a very proud moment in the family history. The first term of William McKinley's election, he was opposed by William Jennings Bryan. And
yeah.
A lot of people know William Jennings
Bryan.
Sure do. He was the Democrat candidate that year. And the popular vote for William McKinley that year was 7,035,000 to 6,467,000 for old W.J.
Well, now, he became a Supreme Court judge.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. The electoral vote, electoral college vote that year was 271 to 176. So there wasn't too much of a doubt that William McKinley was the elector there.
Yeah, right.
And again, another president from Ohio.
Yeah.
We were really dominating the
we were
part of the 20th century there.
Yeah.
So moving on to his second term then in 1900, his opponent was again William Jennings Bryan, the Democrat. Evidently, he wasn't satisfied to be beaten the first time around. He came back for another bite at the apple.
Yeah.
This time,
that's
the
not very smart, is
more.
It?
The popular vote for McKinley is 7,219,000 to 6,358,000. So the margin increased the second trip around, and so did the Electoral College vote, which was 292 to 155. So that's grown. And again, you can see from even the previous election, we've now bumped up again. Now we're up to around 14 million people voting as opposed to 11 million in the previous election.
Wow.
The country is growing.
Yes. Yeah.
McKinley was inaugurated in March of 1901, but unfortunately, on September the 6th of 1901, while visiting the exposition in Buffalo, New York, the Pan American Exposition in Buffalo, New York, he was assassinated while greeting people in a line at the Temple of Music at the Pan American Exposition.
Amazing.
He didn't die right away.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I'm sorry?
I didn't know that. I thought he died right.
No, he was assassinated on the 6th of September and lingered until the 14th. In fact, they actually thought he was going to make it. Newspaper wires and reports that were coming out of the from the doctors that were caring for him there in Dr. Milbourne's residence, who actually lived in Buffalo, New York. That's where he was taken after he was shot.
Mm-hmm.
Thought that maybe he was going to survive. He had started to rally, was talking, and all of a sudden he just took a turn for the worse and died on the 14th of September.
Infection was terrible back then. They didn't
have any gangrene.
Control. Yeah.
They did probe several times. Trying to locate the bullet, couldn't find it. And again, Thomas Alva Edison had just been working on X-ray at the time.
Oh.
And they a number of the people wanted him to bring the X-ray in to where they could X-ray the president and locate the bullet where they would be able to safely remove it. But instead, they continued to probe, which basically is what caused the infection.
Oh,
had they used the X-ray and been able to locate it without probing and causing further damage, McKinley may have survived.
Wow.
He was shot twice. One bullet was not fatal, obviously, but the second located in behind the intestines, and that's the one that they could have safely removed.
Jeez.
Unfortunately,
yeah, for
didn't
him.
Work.
Yeah.
Didn't work.
Changed our history.
He was shot by the person who was an anarchist who was against the country, against politics. And I actually have, he was shot with an Ivor Johnson 32 caliber revolver, which was a popular weapon back in the early 1900s for postal inspectors and police officers, detectives. And I actually have one just like it in my collection.
Is it a small revolver, I assume?
It's a small revolver. Yeah. When Charles Zaslav was in the receiving line for the president, he had a handkerchief like a bandage wrapped around his hand and was concealing the weapon in his hand with this bandage, walked up to the president, extended his other hand to shake hands, and shot him twice.
Jeez. Wow.
With the hand that was wrapped. So, but I do have one that's exactly like it. It isn't the actual gun, obviously.
Okay.
But and that gun is recovered. I think it's in the Smithsonian.
I would guess.
But interestingly enough, a number of years ago, my father-in-law gave me the exact same gun, the Ivor Johnson 32 caliber revolver that belonged to his grandfather, and we're not sure whether he got it because he worked at the post office or what, but it's a small revolver. Yeah, very interesting gun.
Wow.
So now we have bringing in the most well, how do I say this? Boisterous president in the United States.
Okay, I know who it
Teddy
is.
Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah.
Teddy Roosevelt was McKinley's vice president choice for his second term, not his first, but his second term. Mark Hanna, who was McKinley's mouthpiece, I guess. I don't know what you would want to say. Also from Ohio. He was an attorney. He was kind of man behind the man who got McKinley elected the first time around, was concerned about Teddy Roosevelt and thought that he was at governor at the time in New York, and he had burst upon the political scene. He had been a police commissioner in the city of New York and very outspoken, had been in the legislature in New York, and then, of course, was elected governor in New York in 1898.
He was very bully.
Oh, he was. He was the definition of the bully pulpit.
Yeah.
So Hanna thought that they needed to bury him because he was a little bit too radical for the rest of the
Republican Not literally,
party.
Right?
Well,
maybe.
Possibly. In those days, you buried a politician by nominating him for vice president.
Oh, okay.
Vice president up until, actually, Teddy Roosevelt never really went too far.
Yeah.
Not too many of them had been elected on their own. A few had. But most of the ones that before, even once they became vice president, they had no particular job.
Yeah.
They were basically like the show that's on CNN right now. They were the president in waiting.
Yeah.
In
yeah.
case something happened, you know.
Yeah.
But not with Teddy Roosevelt.
Okay.
Teddy Roosevelt then finished out McKinley's term, which amounted to 3 years and about 3.5 months. So it was pretty much a whole term to speak of. Now, I will give him credit for completing that second term of McKinley's the way McKinley would have wanted.
Okay.
He did follow McKinley's policies. He didn't change much. He pretty much did what McKinley had outlined before.
Okay.
However, come 1904, when Teddy Roosevelt ran on his own accord as a Republican, things changed. He was obviously elected, became the 26th president when he ascended to the presidency from the assassination, so he's still the 26th president running for election on his own, not necessarily re-election, but election on his own,
right,
against his opponent, gentleman by the name of Alton B. Parker, who was a Democrat.
I don't recognize
now,
that name.
Notice, too, in these last several elections, we've got basically Republicans and Democrats now
right.
running. All those parties that we experienced early in the 20th century and early in our history have pretty much disappeared, with the exception of that People's Party that we mentioned here a few elections back.
Well, I believe that Teddy will introduce another third party fairly soon in our history.
And we'll get to that shortly,
yeah.
So in this 1904 election, his first trip around on his own, popular vote was 7,600,000 to 5,084,000. So he pretty well knocked Mr. Parker out of the box.
He got it, yeah.
And the electoral vote was 336 to 140. So there wasn't very much
no doubt.
To contend with there. Now, again, a lot of things got done on Teddy's watch. Some of the highlights, and Teddy was one of my favorite presidents, just simply because he wasn't afraid to say what he thought.
Right.
He was
or
there
do what he wanted to.
And to do what he wanted to. Absolutely right. And he was there really. He was the people's president.
Yeah.
He was really there to do good for the people.
He established the national parks.
He did. That was one of the most important things that he did was to... He didn't actually establish the national parks. We had some national parks before he came in.
But nothing big.
And he added tremendously to the amount of acreage that was involved in the national parks.
Yellowstone Park was established by him,
Absolutely,
wasn't it?
Absolutely, right. And he was a great proponent of the park system. He spent a lot of time in the national parks. He loved to go there and camp. He was just a very outdoorsy president.
Yeah.
Having, in his youth, having suffered from asthma and been a very sickly child,
he basically
built his own body. And that was thanks to his father, the first Theodore Roosevelt, who told him that you can build your body and you can do whatever you want to do. You've got the grit, you've got the ability, it just takes work. And that's what he did. He worked himself into a specimen of manhood.
Well, I'm going to tell everybody I built my own body.
There you go.
From the middle out.
But now, the interesting thing about Teddy, he had a great second run on his own. He served 7 years and 3 months as president, but he chose not to seek another term on his own.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of schools of thoughts as to why he chose not to do that. But that's time that he ran on his own in the 1904 election. I wanted to read what he said about that.
About 3 minutes.
Now, this is not the, this is the 1904 election when he's running on his own, on his own. He said, he's not sure what the outcome will be as far as I am personally concerned. I do not know. And I'm quoting, it looks as if I would be renominated. Whether I shall be reelected, I haven't the slightest idea. I know there's a bitter opposition to me from many different sources. Whether I shall have enough support to overcome this opposition, I cannot tell. I suppose few presidents can form the slightest idea of whether their policies have met with approval or not. Certainly I cannot, but as far as I can see, these policies have been right, and I hope that time will justify them. If it doesn't, why, I must abide the fall of the dice, and that there is, and that is all there is to it. Ever yours, Theodore Roosevelt.
Interesting.
So he had decided that he was going to accept those results, whatever they may be. When it came time to decide that he wasn't going to run for a second term, he made this statement after the election was over, and he was still very popular. He made this statement, quote, remember, a new man is in the saddle, and there can't be two presidents after March the 4th.
Oh, so that's where that came from. There can't be two presidents.
That's where that came from. So, hopefully, our current president will take to heart what Teddy Roosevelt said.
There you go.
That there can't be two presidents, in this case, after January the 20th.
Well, I understand he says he's not going to leave the White House, so this is going to be interesting.
It should be interesting, but, you know, the thing I like about Teddy Roosevelt, and he went on after he did not seek his own, he did not seek to run for another term in 1908.
Right.
He went on to go to Africa. He did a year's trip in Africa with his son Kermit. Later on, he went to South America and did the River of Doubt.
Kind of the Ernest Hemingway of presidents.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. He almost lost his life while they were trying to reach the Amazon on what they called the River of Doubt, an unexplored river that had never been there before, along with Kermit. His leg got infected along that trip, and he actually told his son and the people that were with him on that trip, just leave me here. Leave me here. I don't want to burden you and hold you down.
Oh, my.
So he could have died in the jungles of South America along the Amazon River.
Well, we're down to about 15 seconds.
Okay, we'll continue with the 1908 election when we come back.
Okay.
This is 15 minutes, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This one's a 15-minute break, and we'll be back with Fred Malone and the Marion Historical Society, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to WWGH Radio 107.1 FM, your place for holiday fun. For the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams, reading, Yes, Virginia, There Is a Santa Claus.
We're going to start a new tradition here because one of the famous letters of all time that was ever written at any holiday was, Yes, Virginia, There Is a Santa Claus. Little Virginia O'Hanlon, in 1897, wrote this to the New York Sun. And who better to read this than the man with the golden voice? Here's the letter.
Here we go. It says, I'm 8 years old, and some of my little friends say there is no Santa Claus. Papa